Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books and Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. We're taping this show on the 11th of July of 2014. 20 years ago, the Rwandan genocide was in its final days. In a spasm of violence that startled most of the world, Rwandans killed hundreds of thousands of their fellow citizens. Many others were raped, injured, or driven from their homes or forced into hiding. The genocide would end only with the conquering of the country by the Rwandan Patriotic Front. Even then, the violence was not over, as war spread to the nearby Congo and continued for years. Today, rather than interview a specific author, as we usually do on the show, we're going to spend an hour thinking more broadly about a particular genocide, that in Rwanda. The podcast, however, is to some degree inspired by a single book, Alison DeForge's remarkable Leave None to Tell the Story, published in 1999. The book is a tour de force of careful research and analysis, and set the direction for research on Rwanda after it. Nevertheless, it's 15 years old, and since then we've had hundreds of studies examining the genocide and its aftermath. So today, we're going to spend a few minutes assessing that new research, using the broad question of what do we know about Rwanda and the genocide 20 years after? To do so, we have three of the preeminent experts in the field. Scott Strauss started out as a journalist before moving into academia. Here, he has been enormously productive, the author of several books and many articles about Rwanda, genocide studies, and Africa more broadly. I'll just name one of those here, his examination of the behavior of those who killed during the Rwandan genocide, titled The Order of Genocide. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Our second guest, Lars Waldorf, in addition to his academic career, has been a lawyer, a journalist, and a director of Human Rights Watch's field office in Rwanda. He's the author of numerous articles about Rwanda, human rights, and genocide. Here, I'll just note the book he co-edited with Scott, titled Remaking Rwanda, State Building and Human Rights After Mass Violence. Lars, we're thrilled to have you with us as well.
Hi, it's great to be here.
And finally, longtime listeners of the show may be familiar with our last guest, Leanne Fuji. Leanne joined us for an interview about her book, Killing Neighbors, Webs of Violence in Rwanda. Since then, she's been hard at work on a volume comparing violence in Rwanda, Bosnia, and the American South. Leanne, we're glad to have you back as well.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Kelly.
So later in the show, we're going to turn specifically to the issue of how Rwandans have responded to the genocide, one of the focus of the research of our guests. But to begin, I'd like to invite each of our panelists just to identify an aspect of our understanding of the genocide that's remained constant. In other words, what did Alison DeForge and her fellow researchers say 15 years ago that they got right, that still strikes you as true and important? And Leanne, why don't we start with you?
Okay, I think that's a great question to ask as we sort of commemorate the 20 years since the end of the genocide and war in Rwanda. And I would have to say, there's two things that strike me. That is the importance of local dynamics and local leaders during the violence. And I'm going to squeeze in a second, which I think is the importance of evidence-based claims. So this idea that you only make a claim if you have proper evidence to back it up, that you don't make assumptions about anything, but you drive your analysis through actual evidence.
Well, it's good to see we've started the podcast with our first answer actually breaking the rules, but that's okay. Lars, what do you think about this question?
I guess I would have to say that one of the things that I think still amazes me about the book is that it also addresses the war crimes and crimes against humanity that was committed by the Rwandan Patriotic Front. And that was, you know, a difficult and daring thing to do. And again, it showed Allison's commitment, very much a human rights commitment, to victims of all sides of the conflict. And it's part of the reason that the book has had a difficult life getting published in Kenya, Rwanda, in Rwanda.
Yeah, I was actually, that's interesting because I was actually going another direction because I think it's out of print. Is that right?
Yeah, it's been out of print for a while, though it is available on the Human Rights Watch website.
Yeah.
And again, that's also kind of an amazing thing. I mean, this is a book that breaks all the rules about a human rights report, right? I mean, it's huge.
Yeah.
So, but it's stood the test of time in many ways.
And Scott?
So my view would be that the most lasting impact of that book was really to document that genocide occurred. And up until that point, there was certainly a lot of discussion of that. There were a couple of reports. But I think in terms of, you know, some type of systematic documentation of an organized campaign of massive violence against Tutsi civilians in the country, I think that book really broke ground, and that, you know, that remains a primary source in terms of the documentary evidence that we have.
So when I talk to my students about this, and I talk to them a fair amount, one of the things that comes up repeatedly, and this gets at something Leanne said, is the nature of the violence. They're struck by the kind of immediacy of the killing, the brutality of the killing, and especially in the way in which the killing was face-to-face, often between people who knew each other. Scott, both you and Leanne, and I'll start with Scott, have studied this. Can you quickly summarize why the killing and the violence took the shape it did?
So my, you know, my analysis of the situation places a lot of emphasis on the importance of local mobilization, and Leanne's does as well. Mm-hmm. And the Rwandan state, you know, for people who have not been there, this is a small country with a fairly well-developed administration. So even though it's a relatively poor country, it has historically an administrative structure that extends from the center of the country, from the national level, all the way down into local areas and what are called the hills in Rwanda, not villages. And that administrative structure gave the state the ability to effectively mobilize the population very, very quickly and with large numbers. And so I think the key thing to understand about the extent of ordinary civilian participation in the violence are the pre-existing mobilization structures that existed in the country. So what that means is that when government leaders took the decision and military leaders took the decision to basically commit war against the Tutsi population, they had in place institutions that they could draw on that allowed them to reach across the country and get lots of people involved very quickly. So that would be, you know, that would be the sort of number one thing that I would emphasize in terms of trying to understand the sort of the nature of the local level participation.
Leanne, the one thing anybody knows about Rwanda is the idea that there are Tutsis and Hutus. They may not know what they were or who they were, but this is what they've heard of. How important is that ethnic distinction in your sense of the dynamics of killing and how that happened?
Well, one of the things I argue or conclude in my book is that, of course, it was the kind of premise of the genocide. It was the what I call the organizing principle of the genocide, that the main targets were Tutsi. But as many people have pointed out, many scholars of Rwanda have pointed out, was that in those first days of killing, the main targets, especially in Kigali, were obviously political opponents of the of the, you know, group, the regime that who were comprised of the main extremists. So what Scott calls the hardliners, others have called extremists, but these were the people that I think we most associate with the genocide proper. This isn't everybody in the government at the time, so it's important to distinguish that group from other people who may have been in power at the time. And mm-hmm. and I think that that is one of the most important factors. And so, sorry, I'm forgetting the. I was trying so hard to track the question. I need you to just prompt me.
To what degree does this Tutsi and Hutu ethnic distinction drive what happens on the ground?
And that's why, because that question is so loaded that I think that what I tell my students basically is that, you know, it's one lens to understand, but if you only rely on that lens to understand what happened in the lead up, if you only use a sort of ethnic lens, and that's probably why I stopped tracking the question, because I'm almost allergic to it at this point. Mm-hmm. It's the most common one that I think uninformed people. It's the readiest explanation and description of what happened. But what I tell my students and what I insist on is that they go further than that, and I try and show them all the ways in which relying on that lens solely actually distorts and you know, occludes so much of the dynamics that were really, really, really important at the time. So essentially what that does is drives out all the politics, and for me, the politics were key. So it was certainly one important, you know, modality of identification by the state, of self-identification by, you know, just regular people. But I think importantly, we have to remember it was just one of many, and it wasn't always the most important. I think that that's what I tend to emphasize over and over, because we so quickly fall into talking about Rwanda in terms of Hutu and Tutsi.
Scott, Lars, you agree, disagree, want to flesh anything out?
Yeah, well, this is Scott. I mean, I think Lan's absolutely right. But the other thing I would add is that I think you have to be careful about what we mean by ethnicity. So, you know, mm-hmm. it's abundantly clear that in Rwanda, the terms Hutu and Tutsi have a long political history in the country. That is that, you know, the colonial state, even the pre-colonial state, attribute a lot of political significance to these categories. It was a Tutsi monarchy, largely. The colonial system built its structure around the idea that Tutsis were the privileged group in Rwanda. And then we had a Rwandan revolution in the 1950s and 1960s premised on the idea of Hutu nationalism, of the idea that Hutus were the majority and that they should rule. And in the 1990s, in the sort of run-up to the genocide, you know, the overwhelmingly most important factor was the fact that you had an insurgency that was dominated by Tutsis that were now threatening the Hutu state. So there's a very long political history of the importance of these ethnic categories, okay? But what that doesn't mean is that the political history drove relationships on the ground. That is, the relationships between Hutus and Tutsis in the country, you know, at the local level, even at the regional level, even at the political level, there were all kinds of relationships that had nothing to do with ethnicity. And most, you know, I think in Leanne's work, in my work, when you go down to and talk to individuals in Rwanda about their lives before the genocide, they will not say, okay, our lives and our relationships were governed by ethnicity. They were governed by all kinds of other things that had to do with survival, with sending their kids to school, that had to do with putting, you know, food on the table and other kinds of ordinary relationships. And so ethnicity, even though it mattered in this sort of deeper political history of the country and ultimately was the organizing principle of the genocide, as Leanne said, it did not govern everyday relationships in the country and did not drive participation in the violence. It wasn't, people didn't commit genocide because they hated Tutsis, because they had a deep hatred of Tutsis. That just wasn't the case. And so I think the tricky part here, as Leanne was suggesting, is sort of to recognize that there is this long and important political history around ethnicity, and there's a lot of significance there, but that doesn't, we can't infer from that that either that governed relationships between people in the country, or that's what drove participation in the violence.
So, Kelly, can I ask a question?
Yeah, please.
I was going to ask both Lars and Scott whether or not, so I really appreciate what Scott just said. And I just wondered if after that very eloquent explanation, and I'm sure you give that to your students as well, whether or not your students still can't grasp that distinction that you're making of it having a long political history and a separate, I would say, more complex, like a different social history. And by social history, I mean the sort of everyday ways in which ethnicity was or wasn't deployed or was or wasn't important on a day-to-day basis. And whether your students are able to get that, or whether your colleagues, or whether, you know, others, even after giving that very, I think, you know, eloquent explanation, whether they're able to get it or whether they still kind of push back on you.
Lars, you want to take that first?
I think it's, my experience is that it's very difficult for a lot of students to get beyond ethnicity. And, you know, one way I try to do it is by also talking to them about, you know, sort of the number of people who were involved in the genocide who were, you know, married to Tutsi or had Tutsi in-laws, and to understand that there was a real history of relationships and intermarriage and all of that. And again, as you know, Rwanda's this rebuke to, you know, what social psychologists call, you know, the contact hypothesis, the idea that, you know, the more contact we have, the less conflict there's going to be. And you guys in your work, but also Omar McDoom in his work, you know, sort of help turn that a bit on its head and sort of point out that part of the reason the genocide was so efficient and effective in its terrible way was precisely because there was so much contact and people knew who was what and where to find them.
Scott?
Yeah, so when I teach about Rwanda, I usually put it in a comparative genocide context. And I would say that it's not just the Rwanda case that people have this lens of identity differences driving violence, but it applies to the Holocaust, it applies to the Armenian case, it applies to Guatemala, it depends on whatever, almost any other case, with the possible exception of the Khmer Rouge and some of the Stalinist campaigns. But I pretty much labor in the whole class to disabuse students of this primary approach to the study of genocide. And so by the time I get to Rwanda, which is sort of my coup de grace, I think that students at least get the message that the dynamics of genocide are a lot more complicated than interpersonal hatreds and interpersonal distrust based on identity differences, and that it's a much more complex type of violence. So I think both Leanne and Lars are right in the sense that it's very hard to get people to move off of an ethnicity frame, but I think you can do it partly through a discussion of other cases, partly through the Holocaust, the Armenian case, again, whatever your case history is, you know, and also to make the point that there are lots and lots of places around the world that you have identity differences that don't result in genocide or don't even result in large scale violence. So anyway, those are my 2 cents.
You know, let me follow up on that, and I guess I'll ask Scott to start, and then the other two of you can pitch in if you'd like. But we'll talk a little bit more at the end of the show about kind of the lessons learned and the way that's impacted everything from international policy to legal cases and so on. But it does strike me that many people at least come into our classrooms assuming that ethnicity or race or whatever term they're going to use is the driving factor. And I wonder if you think or what impact that has on broader perceptions of genocide and genocide prevention whether it's the academic community or the policy community or what that might mean.
Let me make sure I understand the question. I think within the academic community and the policy community both, I think there's been an enormous growth of understanding and knowledge about the dynamics of genocide over the past 20 years, really since Rwanda and Bosnia. Rwanda and Bosnia happened in the mid-1990s. From a kind of prevention and response point of view, we were just entirely under, I mean, we as in the academic and policy communities were entirely under-equipped to deal with what we were dealing with at that time, both in terms of our models of understanding the dynamics of what was happening. At that point, it was just, you know, the idea that these were these ancient hatreds. And in terms of the policy tools and approaches and strategies that people had, they were extremely poor. You know, whether from peacekeeping to mediation, et cetera, they were very underdeveloped. Since in the past 20 years, a lot has changed. The policy toolkit, so to speak, is much more developed, is much more nuanced, is much more effective on the whole. And the analytic understanding of the dynamics of these events has also really gotten a lot better. And so I'd say now the dominant approach within the policy community and certainly the political science world is the idea that genocide and similar forms of large-scale atrocities are driven by strategic interests, that mm-hmm. the leaders pursue large-scale violence in order to protect power, in order to win wars, and they do so very deliberately with these strategic goals in mind. And so it's not so much these atavistic hatreds and passions that drive it. It's really this sort of very senior level elite strategic thinking and desire to hold power and fend off rivals, defeat rivals, that drive these types of mass atrocities. And so I think that maybe we've gone overboard in that direction, but there has been a really significant change in the academic and policy worlds about how to approach these particular problems. I think that answers your question.
No, and what I hear you saying is that actually the policy and academic communities are ahead of our students in recognizing the complexities and the differing motivations. Is that a kind of fair summary of?
Yeah, I think students, as soon as they hear that perspective, they get it really fast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think the reality when you're dealing with the Rwanda, or you're dealing with the Darfur, or you're dealing with the Cambodia, or whatever those cases are, is that the baseline knowledge for most people in the United States is just so low. I mean, they have no background in high school or before about Africa, about Rwanda specifically, or any of these cases. And there's, I think, in the result, the net result of that type of ignorance or lack of knowledge is to sort of latch on to what we think of as an easy framework to understand things, which is, you know, it's ethnicity. You can get that. People don't like each other because of their differences. And that just is, you know, it doesn't have any sense of history, of background, of understanding of the dynamics of what actually happened. As, you know, Leanne initially said, you need sort of the evidence. People don't walk into classrooms typically with that kind of knowledge. But when you expose them to that kind of knowledge and you expose them to a multitude of different approaches and different studies from different disciplines, pretty quickly students get the message that, okay, this is a lot more interesting and a lot more complicated than, you know, people hating each other because of their race or ethnicity. And we can, you know, we can draw, I think the most effective tools that I can use in the classroom are not studies of Rwanda. There's studies of the Holocaust, there's sort of social psychology studies of, you know, Stanford Prison Experiment or the Milgram Experiment or other things that show that people who in settings that are more similar to the, you know, university and, you know, in the global north will commit incredible harm against other people, you know, with relatively little prompt and not based on, you know, past deep prejudices and hatreds and so forth. Then you get a couple of veterans in the room who talk about the dynamics of war and what fear is like, and, you know, and you're there. You're in a totally different conversation, and it can happen really fast with a relatively limited exposure.
There's lots more we could say about this, but I'd like to move on so that we can talk about some other things. And Lars, I'm going to ask you, to start this, having lived in Rwanda, What was Rwanda like in the years after the genocide and the years you were there? What did it feel like?
I mean, I came to Rwanda really only first in 2001 and had you know, sort of lived there for a number of years, and then came back on and off. So I was really there from like 2001 through 2008. So again, sort of an intermediate period of time. I guess you had a sense of really a place rebuilding itself. And, you know, even in the years that I was there and certainly the years since, I mean, you've had just a terrific, you know, reconstruction of the infrastructure in Rwanda. And you would watch, you know, sort of the new Ministry of Defense go up. Which is this huge structure that kind of dominates the capital, Kigali. And again, there was just sort of a projection of both this government's power, but also sort of the amount of donor money and over time, the amount of private investment that was flowing into Rwanda was really quite impressive and very much dramatically on show. Hmm.
Leanne, you were there maybe later?
Yeah, I was there. I think Lars and I overlapped 1 week. So I got there just at the very end of Lars's stay. And, you know, but I've also been back. I was there in 2004 for about 9.5 months and then went back starting in 2008. So I've been back about 3 or 4 times since. And what struck me is really, I think one of my first trips there was, I think my very first trip was in 2002. And I remember thinking to myself at the time that unless you looked at specific places, if you didn't know, it was impossible to know that only, say, 8 years before that, you know, this terrible, terrible war and genocide had occurred. And that was really shocking to me. It's a place where I feel like it's you know, I felt sort of it was rather suffocating at the time when I was there in 2004. But things have changed over time. And so I don't think I would use even that word. There's the power of the state and the presence of the state, even in a foreigner's daily life, is so ever present that it's almost, you know, it feels heavy all the time, or at least that's how it feels to me. Yet at the same time, I benefit from and I enjoy all the kind of things that the government has managed to have built over the last 10 years. And it's really quite amazing, you know, these skyscrapers and these, you know, these stores that are like Target back home and these, you know, and beautiful roads and marketplaces in the rural areas that are now cemented. And just all these, you know, what I think are incredibly smart kinds of improvements, smart in terms of they make, I think, outsiders' lives really easier, right? The kind of ubiquity of wireless internet and internet cafes and a very kind of, you know, like at least telephonic and computer savvy, educated population, particularly in Kigali, but even outside. And so just the kind of development has been really, really impressive. Yet at the same time, to me, it also feels like a very, it's a very hard place to be at the same time.
Scott, quickly, do you have, what kind of comments would you have?
I mean, you know, I started going to Rwanda in 96 and it was a lot, mm-hmm. It was a lot rawer when I first started going. I traveled in convoys. When you talk to people, the violence of both 94, but also afterwards, what happened in Congo in the early days of those wars was very much on, you know, you could see it in people. And a lot of the things that, you know, that were still getting worked out then, who lived where, who had access to what property, you know, whether or not the state could establish security in the country. And it's really changed so much since then in terms of those kinds of issues. And so it's really been quite a remarkable transformation. So that was my quick response.
Okay, so let me follow up on that because at least a couple of you mentioned the kind of government role. So Lars, I'd like to ask you, at least to start this discussion, how has the government, or what kind of efforts did the government take to address the genocide, and how do we think about them now in terms of how successful they've been?
I mean, I think they've done it in a couple of ways. I mean, the obvious way is that I think they are trying to de-ethnicize Rwanda. So they have, for a number of years, made ethnic or ethnicized speech criminalized in certain categories. They have also forced the large segments of the population to go through various forms of re-education, including re-education camps. And in a sense, they're trying, as this new campaign they have is called I Am Rwanda. They're trying to make everybody think in terms of that they are Rwandan. They're not Hutu and they're not Tutsi. And that is really kind of incredibly ambitious social engineering. It's trying to create a new Rwandan. And it's very difficult to tell how successful that is, partly because it's difficult enough to do research in Rwanda for a number of reasons, but it's very difficult to assess people's attitudes towards ethnicity if you're not really allowed or able easily publicly to ask questions about ethnicity. And so we don't have a clear sense, I think, but, you know, certainly through more ethnographic studies and through private conversations that all of us can have, you do have a sense from some people that, hey, these ethnicity, particularly this shorter period after genocide, just doesn't go away very easily. And there are also other things that the government does that are rather contrary and that reinscribe ethnicity. So starting a few years ago, the government said, okay, you're no longer allowed to talk about the 1994 genocide. It's the 1994 genocide against the Tutsi. Mm-hmm. Okay. So again, reinscribing ethnicity. And I think a lot of what the Chacha, which were these community courts set up to deal with the genocide, I think what they ended up doing was also sort of collectivizing guilt against the majority Hutu population. So again, I think there's these contradictory impulses going on with how the government remembers and tries in its way or it's thinking to prevent future genocide.
Can I add one thing? And that is, I remember one of the first when Gacaca was in its pilot phase, and I was just starting my research. And I remember attending a Gacaca in Kigali. So I think this was 2002. And I remember sort of being astonished at the way they were describing, you know, who could be a victim, how a victim was defined. Mm-hmm. And I remember even at that time being astonished that it was narrowly defined such that only Tutsi could be victims of the genocide. And so, again, that's another way that ethnicity is, you know, sort of deployed in a way that reinscribes what Lars was saying, reinscribes those divisions, but also in a way that the state gets to control or define, as opposed to people themselves kind of defining when or where or how it is or isn't important. And so even this idea that there's no talk of ethnicity sort of comes from this idea that, well, the reason why is because ethnicity is what caused the genocide. So this would be an example, say, if, you know, this was U.S. policy or something, I would say that's really wrongheaded policy because it's built from a faulty premise that in fact ethnicity was the cause. And so therefore, if you get rid of ethnicity, you get rid of any kind of, you know, possibility for that kind of violence or mass violence to happen again. And so the premise and the practices to combine, I think, I agree with Lars that it's sort of, you know, it is still being inscribed and reinscribed, but in very, very particular ways.
Scott, what do you think about those comments?
Right. You know, I agree with a lot of what Lars and Leon said. I think the one thing I would add, I mean, your initial question was, you know, how has the government dealt with the genocide? And I think your listeners just have to know that the post-genocide government has staked its legitimacy, has staked its power to a certain degree on the fact that there has been a genocide and on the fact that they stopped it and continue to be a bulwark against future genocides. And so the post-genocide state in Rwanda has very much used the history of the genocide and used it in particular ways, in the ways that Lars and Leanne have suggested, that serve its interests. And I think that's just very important to understand when thinking about how the genocide gets figured inside Rwanda since 94.
So,
I think if I can add, it's important that, what Scott's saying is very important, but that's the kind of comment that then gets you tarred as, either denying or minimizing genocide. And so I think it's very important to be able to recognize the genocide, to recognize that the current government stopped the genocide, but also to be able to criticize the current government for its political instrumentalization of that same genocide.
In that sense, one of the accusations or one of the ways in which the interim government of Rwanda then the refugees tried to respond to international opinion about the genocide was to point to RPF atrocities and to come up with some kind of suggestion that both sides are doing bad things and it's just what happens in war. What do we now know about the RPF behavior and how do we address that kind of question in this political climate? And I'll just, Leanne, you want to start?
Well, I think it's really important that we distinguish between the types of violence committed. In no way to make certain victims more important than others. This is not to, create a hierarchy of suffering or victimhood. But I think it's important to say that the RPF did not commit genocide, yet it is still important. And this is where we have to distinguish genocide as an analytic term versus a political term. To say that the RPF did not commit a genocide is not to say that those crimes weren't serious. So I think it's important that we don't assign equivalence to all sides in some kind of wrongheaded attempt at being balanced in the way that, so many outsiders did in the case of Bosnia. I think that's just, that's just ridiculous to another extreme. But neither should we say, well, the most serious was, the genocide against the Tutsi. And then deny anything, any ancillary violence, because there were at least three types of violence going on at the time. There was war violence. There was some war violence. There was civilian targeted killing. Some of it was political. Some of it was ethnic based. And then there was, genocide and mass killings. But that genocide itself was, included a lot of people who helped Tutsi, who looked Tutsi, who had too many Tutsi family members or friends who, so you could be Tutsi by association as well. And I think that it's important to make those distinctions, but at the same time, not create a hierarchy of victims and say, well, it only matters if we pay attention to one kind of victim.
Lars?
I think that's all true. And I think part of the problem in post-genocide Rwanda is that there's been no accountability really for the crimes that were committed. There's been maximal accountability for the genocide crimes, and there's been absolutely minimal, virtually no accountability for crimes committed by the RPF. And again, that's not to say that there should be any equivalency, but in a sense, you still need to, have accountability both for the victims, but I think also so that it doesn't sort of perpetuate, notion. I think if there had been more of a full accounting of what the RPF had done, then it would give the lie to the fact that there was any equivalence. So I think having it aired openly, whether in Gacaca or a truth commission or in national trials, sort of allows people in the country to say, hey, this is all victor's justice, and actually what they did is just as bad. And it creates sort of a really nasty, vicious cycle.
You mentioned gachacha. What do we know now, or what are kind of contemporary perspectives on the process of transitional justice, whether it's gachacha or the International Tribunal? How effectively do we think they were?
I mean, I guess it depends upon, you know, sort of what counts in terms of effective or success. I mean, and the big tension there is between fairness or efficiency. And there's a real tension, particularly in the Rwandan context, where there were such a large number of genocide suspects. And there were other justice mechanisms as well, the national courts in Rwanda and domestic courts in places like Belgium and Switzerland using universal jurisdiction. But understandably, it's the International Tribunal and the gachacha courts that have gotten the most attention, partly because they seem to be in such polar opposites. I think, you know, the tribunal ends up having, I think, a very mixed record. On the plus side, it clearly, you know, captured, convicted some of the key players in the genocide, and it really helped develop international law around genocide. On the downside, though, it's just been incredibly slow and incredibly expensive. I mean, in the course of 20 years, it basically did 75 prosecutions. And, I don't know what the final cost is, but it's clearly over $1 billion. But I think more damningly, the tribunal, which was set up by the UN, which was meant to be an independent tribunal, really allowed itself to be manipulated by the Rwandan government. And so I think it has a very tarnished legacy as a result of that. Gachacha were these community courts, and I think that was just this extraordinary radical experiment in transitional justice. And it broke with, if you like, the Nuremberg paradigm, right? It's the anti-Nuremberg. Nuremberg was all about you put sort of 22 of the worst guys on trial, and here's Rwanda saying, no, we're going to put over 1 million people on trial. And they did it in just a few years. It's important, though, to realize that most of the people they put on trial were not being put on trial for genocidal killing. They were being put on trial for property offenses. Okay. And again, then there's difficulties that you're kind of globalizing genocide guilt to a lot of very opportunistic looters and thieves and so on. I think, you know, gachacha clearly accomplished mass justice at a very cheaply, but there was a higher cost to it. I mean, I think the trials were very unfair. And again, I think that the overall result was that it imposed collective guilt on the Hutu majority. And that's something that just doesn't seem very conducive to promoting long-term reconciliation.
Scott, agree, disagree, want to flesh something out?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the last two statements, just as the statements that Lars have made, I just think are incredibly vital for, you know, for listeners to grasp. I think that the reality of the justice process in Rwanda is that it has been one-sided justice, and the international processes have been complicit in that. And the message that sends is that it's political justice. It's justice for one party, for one side that serves its interests. And in the long run, I believe that will undermine the legacy and reality of the genocide and will undermine reconciliation. It certainly means that justice is not a mechanism to achieve reconciliation. I'm not saying that there weren't isolated incidents of people coming together. There was a lot of things that were unearthed, you know, during the gachacha process and certainly in the ICTR trials. But as a global process, I think the message that this sends is that the justice mechanism was used for political purposes. It was used to delegitimize a whole category of people and its history, and to essentially give impunity to the other side. And I think that's how it's understood in Rwanda. And so again, this is not a question of equivalences. This is not a question of denial. It's just a question of the instrumentalization of the genocide and its memory. And I think it's in the long run, and you know, Lars and I have been saying this a lot, is like it does not serve the interests of the country to do that. It may run in the short term. It might create. It might benefit those in power, but in the long run, I don't think it's going to help. I think it will harm.
One of the things the tribunal is known for is recognizing the importance of gender and rape, and relatively quickly. And I guess I'll ask Leanne this first. What do we now know about gender and the genocide and the aftermath of genocide?
Well, I think what I've learned just from my more recent research is that, and I don't know how much, my guess is this varied from region, from commune perhaps, but that there were, at least in my research site and around my research site, there were people who there were active genocidaire who actively worked against the killing of women and children. And a lot of them had personal interest in doing so. They had Tutsi wives or girlfriends. But I found that really interesting. That's something I've just learned really recently through my recent research that in doing so, for instance, even at the very, very local level, you know, someone told me there was this incident between these two different, two different men in these killing groups. And one of them said, well, you know, we need to kill the women and children now. And the other, the other guy said, well, if you kill my wife, I'm going to come kill your wife and your children too. And so there was, I think, differing feelings about what, you know, who should be killed and what the status of women and children should be. Of course, we know that there are plenty of places where, you know, after a week or even from the very beginning, women and children were targeted. I mean, of course, we know that. But that was just one aspect that I found surprising. As far as the targeting of women specifically for rape, I don't know that much about that. That's not my area of study. I don't have a lot of data on that question. I know others are working on that question in a comparative fashion. That's a very important question. I would say, and it's an area where we definitely need more, more data, more knowledge, I think. And I guess I would say that there is something about the power of that kind of gender-specific violence that we have not studied enough. Like, that's definitely one area where we could understand better the power behind these kind of mass rapes. And I think one of the things that we're probably going to uncover, which scholars have started to uncover in this area of sexual violence, is that it wasn't just, I think what we'll find out is that it wasn't just Tutsi women, that certain Hutu women were also probably raped, and that there were also probably, men and boys who were targeted as well. And so I just think that that is an area where that just begs for more research and also, I think, a comparative lens.
Mm-hmm. And Scott, just to flip the question around, to what extent is the aftermath of the genocide a gendered kind of activity or experience? The experience of living in Rwanda in 96 or 98 or 2000, to what extent does that vary for women or men, or is that affected by the way in which the demographics emerged outside of after the genocide?
Yeah, Lars and Leanne may be better positioned
and
to answer that.
I'm happy to have Lars pitch in if he'd like.
I think that, you know, one thing to say is that obviously Rwanda gets a lot of acclaim for having, you know, the largest percentage of women parliamentarians in the world. And, you know, and other people like Jenny Burnett, who've looked at this more closely, have, I think, you know, managed to show that, you know, that is also, there's a lot of window dressing to that. And, you know, for me, what I saw is that women, there were very strong women's organizations right after the genocide, the women's survivor organizations, and they really pressed the government to make sure that rape was in the first category and that was tried in the national courts and that was not tried in the Gacaca courts, so that there would be really full accountability for rape. And then as those sort of strong women in civil society organizations got appointed to government posts, got appointed to parliament, the civil society activism died away. And over time, the Rwandan government moved rape cases into Gacaca without any real protest. And so, you know, at the same time, you have sort of women demonstrably becoming more politically powerful in terms of representation in parliament, their actual women-friendly, gender-friendly policies in terms of whether rape should be done at a community court or whether it should be done in national courts falls away. And so I think that's again, partly about how, you know, the government's been really incredibly successful at co-opting a lot of, you know, sort of what had been great civil society activism.
Well, we've only got a few minutes left. And so, Scott, I'd just like to start concluding by asking you to, when I talk to my students, they know the Holocaust. A few have heard of Armenia. A few have heard of Bosnia. Most all of them have at least heard about Rwanda. Why has Rwanda had so much attention paid to it?
So I think there are a couple answers to that question. I think, first of all, from a sort of political origins of knowledge, as I said earlier, and others have said too, is that the current government in Rwanda has very much promoted a particular history of the genocide and wants the knowledge of the genocide and a particular understanding of the genocide to be widespread throughout the world. So that means that they've facilitated a lot of different kinds of information about it. They've provided a very strong narrative about it. So I think that there's sort of that element is the first one. You know, that's totally different from almost any other case that you just cited. Bosnia is very contested. And certainly in Turkey, there's, close denial. And the Holocaust is, you know, probably the most similar, but it has a more complicated history as well. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is that we've had a number of very talented writers, filmmakers, who discovered Rwanda and created Manichaean histories in the sense of, you know, there were clear good guys and clear bad guys in the story, and created a story of the Rwandan genocide that was immediately recognizable. There was this incredible horror that one side planned, devised, that is due in the long run to European colonialism. And when they executed this plan, this strategy, the world turned away, abandoned Rwanda at its worst moment, and this horrible violence took place. Now, that's not wrong. That's a true narrative of what happened, but it leaves out a lot of complication, a lot of nuance, that I think the scholars have been trying to, in the last 50 years, have been trying to re-inject into the story. But nonetheless, that narrative, that clean narrative of this horror that existed, that people knew about, and in some ways the West is responsible for, is a narrative that very much resonated in popular culture in the 1990s and the 2000s. So you have political interests, you have a bunch of sort of talented writers and filmmakers who took on the story, and you have, you know, a pretty simplistic narrative that appealed to a lot of different people. And I think, you know, films like Hotel Rwanda, books like Phil Gorovich's We Wish to Inform You and others, really had pretty big, you know, Samantha Powers book. These had pretty dramatic impacts in popular culture. We don't have equivalents for Bosnia or for some of the other cases. So that would be my main answer.
So Lars and then Leanne, and I'll start with Lars. What kind of conclusions have people drawn from the Rwandan genocide about how they need to change behavior, whether on the international level or the national level? And I guess mostly I'm thinking about the international level, whether on governments or the UN or NGOs. What kind of conclusions have they drawn from the Rwandan genocide, and how have they tried to put them into practice?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that if we look at sort of the international response to mass violence in a place like the Central African Republic, I do think it shows we've come a long way in the last 20 years, and that some of the lessons from Rwanda have been learned. Probably the best example of that is in terms of peacekeeping operations, right? Sort of, you know, what you have post-Rwanda is that it created a rethink within the United Nations by Kofi Annan, by Brahimi, about, you know, sort of their peacekeepers have to do more than just protect themselves. They also have to protect civilians. And so you have these robust UN, AU peacekeeping operations that use force and oftentimes a lot of force to protect civilians. And I think that's a very important thing. Another important thing is that you have a number of new UN mechanisms that have come about. So you've got the special advisors on prevention of genocide, special advisors on responsibility to protect. You also have sort of the use of the International Criminal Court as a credible threat to kind of prosecute, punish crimes against humanity, and, you know, trying to use it at times as a deterrent. And, you know, again, recognizing, as Scott said earlier, that, you know, we're not talking about irrational frenzies. We're talking about, you know, political leaders in these countries who are making rational choices to use mass violence. And then you're trying to use, you know, things like the International Criminal Court to get them to adjust their cost-benefit analysis. And so I think that is all incredibly important. Has it stopped killing in the Central African Republic? Of course not. But I still think it's you know, we've come a long way. And I think it is important to recognize that without, of course, we can't rest on laurels looking at Central African Republic. There's a lot more that must and needs to be done. But again, I think that that is an accomplishment. And I think it's something that really was driven by the Rwandan genocide.
Leanne, any?
Yeah, I guess I would say I'm a little bit more pessimistic. And and I just would say that my fear is that, you know, the U.S., I'm just mostly speaking about the U.S. in the sense that we have people who actually have who have very good knowledge of some of these places. And yet I'm not sure how much that knowledge dribbles up to those who are actually, you know, briefing the president or you know, the higher ups. And so my worry is that we end up learning the wrong lessons, and that the way, you know, our diplomatic system, our foreign service system works is that it's always about churn and not getting too close to a particular place because of, you know, because there's this idea that if you're too close, you're not objective, which is, you know, sort of ridiculous from a researcher standpoint. I mean, as researchers, we want to get as close as possible precisely because we believe that getting closer actually gets us at the real dynamics that are going on. So my fear is that we haven't drawn that we've learned some, but then that knowledge sometimes gets lost. I think maybe one of the things we've learned are the practicalities or impracticalities and limitations of ad hoc courts, of these international tribunals in general. I mean, the trend, this is not my area, but the trend seems to be, you know, either one permanent court with ICC without the U.S. as a signatory, and then these hybrid courts on the ground, as in Sierra Leone and Cambodia. And maybe that is a response to the fact that both the ICTY and the ICTR have very mixed kinds of legacies. And maybe it's too soon to tell, actually. But a lot of the research shows that, you know, they haven't done what they, you know, set out to do. On the other hand, I always wonder why we put on those kinds of international tribunals, the set of goals that we always have about reconciliation. But this is the kind of research that, you know, I have a student doing this, and I'm sure, you know, Lars and Scott both have students studying the impact of these courts. And I think there are a lot of things that we're going to be really, you know, shocked and saddened by, and other things that we're going to be, one of the things these courts do is they do document, you know, going back to your first question, what Scott said about the importance of Allison's book, that it documented that a genocide had occurred. And so I think maybe one of the things these courts do, which wasn't really part of their mandate, was to really document. And so you can disagree politically with the findings of the courts, but there is something about the sheer amassing of that kind of information for researchers down the line and for just general knowledge, for just better knowledge about, you know, what really happened, I think, in these two cases of former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, which I think is actually quite important. But I worry that as we get into conversations about what's happening in the Middle East or even in Afghanistan or Iraq now, that again we fall back into these really, really too facile terms of sectarian or, you know, those people have been fighting each other for thousands of years. And, you know, I always like to say, well, you know, those Democrats and Republicans have been fighting each other for thousands of years. And, you know, just to make the point that, you know, when we say that about certain kinds of labels, it sounds ridiculous and that we should be smarter than that because we now have that information. Information is more readily available now with the internet. And so I feel like, you know, we need to use that knowledge more.
And that's actually an excellent transition to my final question. We've taken up a lot of your time, and I really appreciated that. I'd just like to offer each of you maybe 30 seconds to recommend a book, or maybe it's a movie or a documentary or something that for people who are listening who want to go further, either with Rwanda, and your recommendation may be about Rwanda specifically, or maybe just inspired by one of the issues we've talked about. What would you recommend that they read or they watch? And I'll just start with Scott.
So I think that with the exception of Leanne and Lars's work, the most important publication on the genocide in Rwanda is the work of the French sociologist André Guichaud. And most of your readers are probably not French speakers, or many of them are probably not. But we are in the process of translating and publishing through the University of Wisconsin Press his main book on the history of the genocide, which I think takes Allison's insights and some of her research, but gives it a different interpretation, and I think is the most important work at the national level since her book. So I have that as something to look out for. In terms of the various movies, this might be useful to some readers. I think I would love Lars's and Leanne's views on this as well, but I think that my two favorite on Rwanda are the Triumph of Evil, which is the PBS Frontline documentary on intervention and the sort of dynamic for the intervention, which I just think is still a classic and it's just great. It has some, I think, a couple errors, but it's still very good. And then in terms of the reconstruction of the genocide, the dynamics of the genocide, I think that the HBO film Sometimes in April is my first choice. But those are my initial two cents.
How about you, Lars?
I like both of Scott's choices in movies. The one that I use in teaching and that I've seen many times and that I've got the poster on my wall that is staring at me all the time. It's not very cheerful. It's My Neighbor, My Killer by Anne Aguillon, who's a friend and somebody I met in Rwanda. And I actually only became a friend with her because I liked her movies so much. It's a documentary about life in on a hill sort of over the course of 9 years. And it really looks at Gacaca and the return of people from detention and how they get reintegrated and not reintegrated back into the community. And it's just fascinating. And it's great to show scenes of it to students in class and say, okay, does this look like reconciliation to you or not? Does this look like justice to you or not? And it really kind of sparks an incredible debate.
This is Scott. I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
It's just such a powerful film, and readers should absolutely look at it. And I don't know why I didn't think of it. So I want to remove my suggestions and take part of this thing.
Yeah. I'll give you a copy of the poster.
I'm looking at it right now. I'm in my office. I'm looking at it. I was looking at my bookshelf, not my wall.
As my 7-year-old would say, there's no tag backs.
the other film, but it's sadly unavailable. It was a short Canadian film, the first documentary film on Romeo Dallaire. I think it was called The Just Man. And it was by maybe Steven Silver or somebody like that. And it is so moving and powerful. And basically, Dallaire it's, you know, he hasn't recovered yet. He hasn't gotten used to telling his story yet. And so he basically breaks down at the end of the film and just says, turn it off. And that's the way the film ends, as he has a breakdown.
Yeah.
And it is very, very moving. I mean, you can get glimpses, similar glimpses in the PBS Ghosts of Rwanda, but in terms of power, I don't know why that film isn't available, but if anybody's listening out there who knows anything about film production, get that film out there.
It's probably on YouTube, Lars.
Oh, I know I'm incompetent and a Luddite, but I have checked that.
So
Leanne, you get the last
word. I would agree with all of those. I show them for different reasons. Of course I show Anne Aguillon's films, or portions of it. I also show parts of Ghost of Rwanda to my students. I just think I do it almost as much for the visuals. I think it's really important for students to, first of all, to get off their their phone and their computers, and to actually see what genocide looks like. There are these opening sequences in Ghost of Rwanda. They're so shocking, even after all these years of studying the genocide. And it's just, you know, it's just a camera that clearly the vehicle was going through a road, and the cameraman just, you know, took shots of the bodies on the ground. And you can see that they're bodies. And I think that rolls during the opening credits. And I show it almost, you know, just for those kinds of images, so that the students understand that we're talking about real people, and this isn't some abstract idea, but something that really, really happened. And then I think it's great. Anne's work is so wonderful for actually seeing actual people talking about what did or didn't happen in their hill. And then we had the same conversation when I showed that to a big first year freshman class, which was, you know, is he telling the truth? And, you know, do you think he's telling the truth? And I do think so I use these different ones for different reasons. And speaking of the lair, you know, I hadn't thought of it this way, but I guess I probably, you know, I always say my mother's the most knowledgeable, like, Rwanda person in all of Washington State where she lives. And she may well be, but one of the books she read when I started to do my research was Shake Hands with the Devil.
Yeah.
And because it's a memoir, it's a little bit more accessible. And it really talks about some of these events, you know, from a really, obviously really, really personal first-person account, which I think is, which we know cost him, you know, dearly. And I think that that's probably the one to a general audience. For students, I would say, if there are any student listeners, I would say the one piece that is not about Rwanda, but that I wish every student who is interested in these issues would read is Rogers Brubaker, a sociologist at UCLA, has this very short piece called Ethnicity Without Groups. And it's not an easy piece to read. And there's a ton in there that's, I think, important for all of us to understand who want to understand these events, these very tragic events, better. And if there's one piece that I would tell any student to read, it would be Rogers Brubaker, Ethnicity Without Groups.
Those are all wonderful suggestions, and for those of you who are listening, I highly encourage you all to pursue those. And I want to say thank you so much to all of the panelists, to Scott and Lars and Leanne. This has been wonderfully interesting and entertaining. I appreciate your time and your effort, and thanks again.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a roundtable conversation about the Rwandan genocide with Scott Strauss, Leanne Fuji, and Lars Waldorf. If you enjoyed this discussion, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll come back next time when I'll talk with Deborah Meyerson about her new book, On the Path to Genocide, Armenia and Rwanda Reexamined. In the meantime, thanks for the download and have a great month.